Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Beyond ending war, what does it take to make a lasting quality peace?
But first, Libya has devolved into a morass of civil war. Why did the civil war break out and why does it persist? I'm Doug Becker. Since the toppling of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, Libya has been one of the bloodiest countries in the world. A 2014 election resulted in a split between groups, each claiming to be the legitimate government of the nation, and the country plunged into civil war. As a result of this continued fighting, the UN Refugee Agency estimates that more than 200,000 people have been internally displaced, and approximately 1.3 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance. In this segment, we'll examine the causes of the ongoing civil war in Libya and why it persists. Our panel is Hala Hoyo, adjunct instructor of political science at Rosary College at Dominican University. She is the author of Tribes in Libya, From Social Organization to Political Power, The Libyan Revolution and Women's Participation in Politics and Media, and The Muslim Brotherhood, Libya as the Last Resort for continued existence of the global movement. And Alan J. Kupperman, associate professor of public affairs and the founding coordinator of the Nuclear Proliferation Prevention Project at the University of Texas, Austin, in the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Affairs. He's the author of Constitutions and Conflict Management in Africa, Preventing Civil War Through Institutional Design, Did R2P Foster Violence in Libya, and Obama's Libya Debacle. Thank you very much for joining us. Hala Hoyo, we'll start with you. This is a war often described as the second Libyan civil war, but in many ways it was kind of a continuation of the first, as I understand. What's the cause of the war and why does it continue to persist?
Thank you for having me. Well, as a lot of us know that the war in Libya started in 2011 as part of the Arab Spring revolutions that took place in the Middle Eastern region. At that time, the Libyans protested against the long-term dictatorship regime of Muammar Gaddafi. And they were kind of like encouraged by what was going on in the region, in Tunisia and other countries as well. So that was the beginning of the war. And since then, as you mentioned, Libya didn't stabilize. It's still like the conflict is continuing, but it takes different forms. Sometimes it is an armed conflict. Sometimes it's a political one. Sometimes it's both of them. But the thing is, it's still going on.
And so to kind of follow that up, I know that there's these two factions that are each claiming legitimacy. Are any of these factions kind of continuations of the Gaddafi regime, or is this an ideological split, or is it really just individual groups vying for power and each claiming to be legitimate?
This is interesting because the faces change over the time. So it's like since 10 years ago, there were like some faces that were in the front, and then they kind of replaced by other people. And there's always this conflict between two parties, which could be different from another. So in the beginning, let's agree that all the parties that are in the part of the conflict right now, none of them would say that they or Gaddafi's ideology or Gaddafi's ideas, even though you will find in both sides or all sides, if we want to say that, that there were a lot of people that were working with Gaddafi at one point or part of his system. So it's not, and then this is like what they used to attack each other, like you, Gaddafi, or you were part of his, group or whatever. But the thing is, since 2014, we have some constant figures that they're still playing a role in the fight or in the conflict in Libya. One of them is Haftar, General Khalifa Haftar. He used to be one of Gaddafi's small group of officers who did the 1969 coup with him, but then he became part of that position at one point, and he remained in a position until the revolution in 2011 when he came back, and he was welcomed as a hero because he joined the revolutionaries, he joined the fight against Gaddafi, and then after that he had his own agenda and he wants to become the new ruler of Libya, and he knows how to play the game, and that's what made him remain in the game up until now. And then we have other parties or other groups. We have the Islamists, and the major Islamist group we have is the Muslim Brotherhood. And in my study on Muslim Brotherhood, since they don't have a lot of grassroots presence in Libya, they kind of like camouflage their presence and under different names, because in general, the public in Libya, they don't really accept them because they always believe that they have foreign roots in Egypt. And that's what kind of like make the public suspicious about their intentions and their goals. So these are two main groups that they're still in the game, or they're still part of the conflict. The conflict can take different phases. And as I said, you'll see different faces, different people. Right now, we have this fight between the Dbeiba government and Bashaga government, which is like, it's just a conflict that came from nowhere. You know, when you feel like, okay, the situation is becoming to, the conflict is becoming to an end, we're going to have elections, and it's just like something happened and a new conflict emerges. And I think this is the situation with you right now.
Alan Kupperman, will bring you into this conversation. Part of what I think Kalahoyo was describing is a kind of lawlessness, and creates, you know, the space where groups can rise up and attack and, you know, plunge the country into war. How much of that emanates from the intervention in 2011? Is this a war that ironically was caused by an intervention that was supposed to improve human rights in Libya?
Certainly, this current situation in Libya and the situation since 2011, which we can characterize either as anarchy or as a failed state, is a direct result of the NATO-led intervention in 2011. And that was not its intention, but, you know, that's the fact. Libya was not a failed state. It was, in fact, the richest state in Africa on a per capita basis. And so it had many problems, and it was not a democracy by any means, but it was doing fairly well economically, and you didn't have this anarchy with hundreds of different militia groups controlling little pockets of territory and then having fights against each other. You didn't have this problem of two competing governments that you've had. You didn't have this intervention on opposing sides by foreign countries, all of which have contributed to the chaos in Libya. So yes, we broke a NATO-led intervention, but it had strong support also from Middle Eastern countries, especially Qatar. We broke Humpty Dumpty, and then we have failed to put it back together again. And that's the consequence. I have ideas on what could end this chaos.
I want to circle back to that, but I want to go to Halahoyo and actually have you both respond to this, but I'll start with her. There was this tendency in 2011, and just sort of broadly, the perception was, well, Gaddafi has been this thorn in the side of the West for such a long time. Let's just get rid of Gaddafi, and whatever comes after has to be better. So, Professor Hoyo, how often is this, you know, Western policy, and is it wrongheaded to think you've got this leader who's committing atrocities, this leader is a strong man, undemocratic, et cetera. Let's get rid of him. And then whatever comes after, it's got to be better, right?
Exactly. Just like what happened in Iraq, right? Just get rid of Saddam Hussein and everything will be good. Well, the problem is that even though Gaddafi is out of the picture, but his legacy lives on. And the damage that he caused in Libya and to the Libyans, it's not over. You cannot kind of end a person's regime or dictatorship and expect that everything will be great the next day. I kind of disagree with your guest on how Libya was in a better. Maybe I misunderstood that, but I think he kind of referring to Libya as it was in a better situation under Gaddafi, economically or socially or whatever. It was because no one had the right to kill other than him. So the thing is, Libya didn't have a law, rule of law under Gaddafi regime, because people would spend decades in prison with no actual accusation or with no, like, not for nothing, just because they oppose him. He was above the law. So it's like a thing, it's a situation that Libyans got rid of Gaddafi, but now we have small Gaddafis all over Libya because they were raised by him. The whole society was under his command for over 40 years. The people in Libya were not trained on democratic ideas or ideologies or understanding the other opinion or accepting the other opinion. It's all about changing the social norms, changing the political culture of Libya in order for Libya to succeed. As I say, it's not a rebuilding, but it's a creation of a new state. It's not, I don't know how to translate that, but one of the ideas that Gaddafi had in his Green Book is that he, of course, we all know that he was opposed to a party system. So one of his sayings in the Green Book was Man tahazzaba khan, which translates into whoever accepts party system committed the greatest betrayal to his country. And the new generation, the generation that was born and raised under his system and studied in his schools, a lot of those kids, they actually believe that this saying is a saying by Prophet Muhammad, not from the Green Book. And it's true. Sometimes it's hard to comprehend the effect of Gaddafi on the way Libyans think and act. You can see it in their actions now, because the idea of national identity, the idea of belonging to Libya, the idea of having this feeling of, I have to build my state, I have to build my nation, it wasn't born with the Libyans, and it wasn't integrated in their education system. It was all towards Gaddafi and praising Gaddafi and his ideology and his system. And now when he's gone, they kind of like, they lost their compass.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing civil war in Libya with Hala Hueyo of Dominican University and Ellen Kupperman of the University of Texas, Austin. Professor Kupperman, I want to give you the chance to respond. First of all, how much better or worse Libya, you know, was with Gaddafi, but, you know, quite distinctly then, how do you build a post-Gaddafi state that is peaceful, respects human rights, maybe even democratic?
Well, my point was that I think most Libyans, if given the choice between today's chaos and what they had under Gaddafi, would probably opt for Gaddafi. That was even true in polls within the first year of the revolution. And things have gotten a lot worse since then. And again, what does that mean? That means that Professor Alhala Hueyo is absolutely correct that this was a dictatorship, and that any challenge to the regime, especially any violent challenge to the regime, was met with brutality, with imprisonment, with torture, and potentially with execution. So I was personally not a supporter of Gaddafi in terms of his domestic policy or his international policy. However, the system was relatively stable. That means that you could walk the streets safely. That meant the electricity was on 24 hours a day, not 4 hours a day, 24 hours a day. And there's you know, the most basic human right may be this ability to live, feed yourself, and not be at risk of sudden violent death just for walking the street. So I think that you know, Libya was very flawed under Gaddafi, but the quality of life, aside from political rights, was pretty good in Africa. And so, you know, what Libya needed was a transition from that, a peaceful transition from that. Instead, what many NATO countries and other countries, including Qatar, decided to do was to violently overthrow that regime by remarkably supporting radical Islamist militants from northeastern Libya, who succeeded ultimately at capturing, torturing, and assassinating Gaddafi, but could not establish a monopoly of the legitimate use of force in the country. And that's why Libya has been a failed state ever since. And you look at the human rights organizations around the world, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, they will identify massive human rights violations since 2011 that are worse than what they identified under Gaddafi. The death rate, much higher. And then, of course, the economic situation, much worse than it was under Gaddafi. So again, I'm not praising Gaddafi. I'm just saying, as you said in your intro, that the way that the international community, quote unquote, went about trying to fix Libya did not fix it, didn't improve it, made it worse. And now it's very difficult to put it back together. But I have some ideas on that if the time for me to talk about that.
I'd love to hear some of those ideas. What's the way out of the civil war?
So your other guest is absolutely right that there's all sorts of divisions. There's individuals, there's Islamists versus more secular. But, you know, underlying in Libya or even before Gaddafi has been a regional split between East and West. And so before Gaddafi, it was viewed that the East of Libya dominated the country. And then Gaddafi came in, and then it was viewed that the west of Libya dominated the country. And the east was very resentful. And that's why when you saw the uprising in 2011, you saw it come from the east, especially the militant uprising started there. So now, with this, over the last few years, with these two competing governments, again, lo and behold, you see one based in Tripoli, and one based in the East. And when you saw the civil war really reignite in 2019-2020, you saw forces from the East trying to come and conquer the West. And then you saw international military interveners, Russia come in on behalf of the East, and Turkey come in on behalf of the West. And they reached a military stalemate. And it's been stalemated ever since. The good news is it was a military stalemate, so both sides realized, well, let's just stop the fighting for now. And so people now talk about, well, we need elections. But, you know, as I talked about in my book on constitutional design and conflict management, it's very, very important to have your constitution right before you have elections. And what they decided to do in Libya, what they planned to do in December of last year, was to have an election before the constitution was revised. And so somebody would have won that election. And that person would have been viewed as either favorable to the East, in which case the West would have used force, or favorable to the West, and then the East would have used force. And so from this perspective, the answer is to first do a constitutional reform that provides guarantees to both the East and the West. This is what in academia we call power sharing or a consociational democracy. And if you make guarantees in the Constitution, don't worry, your security, your economy in the East is guaranteed. Same thing for the West. Then the stakes of the election are lower and the outcome of the election is less likely to trigger renewed violence. So I was very unhappy when they were planning elections in December of last year. They got scuttled mainly because of some people were running that other people didn't want to have running. So they said, well, let's just cancel the election. And I think that was very fortunate for Libya, because I think had they held the election, it would have triggered renewed civil war. I think what they should do now is postpone the elections, agree to have a constitutional convention, come up with a new constitution that provides very rock solid power sharing guarantees to the two halves of the country, and only then hold an election. I can't guarantee that it'll work, but I think that's the best path forward to try to avoid another civil war in Libya.
And Halahueo, how confident are you that the answer lies with political institutions, as Alan Kupperman has suggested? Or what other variables would you want to include as how we might resolve this conflict?
It's definitely part of the equation, no doubt. Of course, building strong institutions is one of the requirements to build a strong state. But also, we shouldn't ignore other factors that have great importance in the situation in Libya. One of them, Professor Kupperman, of course, he covered some of the issues, which is security, which is a huge deal in Libya right now. How can people go outside and vote in elections where they don't feel secure or safe enough for their own life? The other thing is, you know, the daily needs of the people. That's also a huge concern for the public. And it is important building political institutions, but I agree with Professor Kupperman that you need to do other things first. And, you know, writing the constitution should have been done years ago. It took way longer than it should. Some of the suggestions was to go back to the constitution that Libya had under the monarchy and make some adjustments and just use it for the time being. They didn't agree on that. Okay, can we just like have some sort of base for the constitution that we can have right now, and then later on we can make some amendments? Didn't work. The constitution committee is kind of like in hibernation or something. It's like they're not doing anything. They're just sitting there, and they have their own issues and they have their own disagreements. So that's also contributed to the issue. I believe that security is one of the big issues. I believe that the rule of law should be activated again. And it's not just about sitting down at the table and discuss what we should do. It's about having the real intention to get Libya out of this situation. Because I don't have full confidence on those parties that are fighting that they actually want the interests of the Libyans or the public or the state over their own personal interests. And this is clear in the fight we see right now. Both parties have their own personal interests above the interests of the nation. I'm against a fight at all counts, but it's kind of like reoccurring incident every time we feel like the situation is getting better and they're gonna solve the issue soon. Something happened and bring Libya back to square one.
And Alan Kupperman, so the last question, just have a few minutes left. But you made reference to Russia, Turkey being engaged. Is the problem in Libya that there's too much international focus, too much international intervention in the country? Or is the problem there's not enough?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess the simplistic answer would be it's not that there's too much intervention, it's of the wrong kind. And so, you know, Turkey intervened because the Western government said, well, we'll give you all sorts of sea rights in the Mediterranean. So it's essentially, you know, a payoff. And Russia intervened for its reasons, which may include partially trying to fight Islamic radicalism, but also include financial incentives. And, you know, ideally, you'd want international intervention focused not on self-interest, but on the interest of Libya. And, you know, if the United States and Europe had a better conception of enlightened self-interest, they would realize that a stable and successful Libya would also be in the interest of the West, Western world. So if you look at what happened after 2011, after the intervention turned Libya into a failed state, what happened? Well, you got this exodus of Malian troops that had been fighting for Gaddafi, and they went in and started a civil war in Mali that continues to this day. And now the northern half of Mali is infested and controlled by radical Islamists. You also had the infiltration into Libya itself of both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. You also had this proliferation of weapons from Libya, because Gaddafi had this, you know, very, very large arsenal of relatively sophisticated weapons. And so things like man-portable surface-to-air missiles that can shoot down planes went missing from Libya. They were found in West Africa. They were found in East Africa. They were found in the Middle East, and they were used to shoot down planes and helicopters. So all of that is what you get when you have an unstable Libya. That's bad, not just for Libya, but also bad for the West. But, you know, the reality is that the United States and Europe tend to intervene only when things get, or to intervene significantly only when things get violent. So, you know, the good news about 2020 is that there was a military stalemate reached, so at least there's not full-scale civil war. But the bad news is, because there's no full-scale civil war, the U.S. and the EU are not really investing in a solution for Libya. Their resources are going elsewhere, whether it's Ukraine or whether it's East Asia to confront China, or even if it's, you know, in Afghanistan to try and assassinate the head of successfully assassinate the head of Al-Qaeda. So there needs to be more Western intervention, I think, in Libya, too, but it also has to be focused properly. And I really do think that rather than pushing for fast elections, we should be pushing for fast constitutional reform. We'll see if that happens.
I think that's an appropriate place to stop in this conversation. But of course, the war continues, the conflict continues, maybe a stalemate, but certainly no resolution. And hopefully the lessons learned here is A, have a plan when you intervene militarily to try to bring some degree of stability rather than walk away. And B, if there is a conflict and you don't engage in positive ways, you know, ways to try to build peace, the effects can be rather devastating well beyond those borders as well. So I want to thank our guests today. We've been discussing the ongoing conflict, the civil war in Libya. Our guests today have been Hala Hueyo, who is an adjunct professor of political science at Rosary College at Dominican University. She's the author of Tribes in Libya, From Social Organization to Political Power, The Libyan Revolution and Women's Participation in Politics and Media, and The Muslim Brotherhood, Libya as the Last Resort for the Continued Existence of the Global Movement. And Alan Kupperman, Associate Professor of Public Affairs and also the founding coordinator of the Nuclear Proliferation Prevention Project at the University of Texas, Austin, the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Affairs. He is the author of Constitutions and Conflict Management in Africa, Preventing Civil War Through Institutional Design, Did R2P Foster Violence in Libya, and Obama's Libya Debacle. Thank you both very much for joining us.
When we come back, what it means to have quality peace. Stay tuned.
Everything in life is a negotiation.
This interview was recorded on November 22, 2015.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Beyond ending war, what does it take to make a lasting quality peace? With us is Professor Peter Wallenstein. He's a professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University, Sweden, and a research professor of peace studies in the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of Quality Peace, Peacebuilding, Victory, and World Order, Understanding Conflict Resolution, Peace, War, and the Global System, and the editor of the volume International Sanctions Between Wars and Words. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Peter Wallenstein. It's great to have you here with us.
It is my pleasure to talk to you.
Let's start with the very premise of your new book, Quality Peace. How do you distinguish what it means to have quality peace as opposed to peace that doesn't have quality?
This comes from a lot of discussions about peace building and what happens after a war and whether it is satisfactory only that the war ends and we should then call that peace. So we talk about the end of the Second World War as peace coming to Europe or Asia. But of course that is pretty unsatisfactory. It's fine that the war is over, but there needs to be more, because what we are really concerned about is the recurrence of war, that it will come back. So trying to think about that and trying to see what other scholars have done, I came to the conclusion that we should call this quality peace. The kind of peace we want is not just the absence of war, it's also something that has the conditions that will prevent the recurrence of war.
So
that was the background. Yeah.
So it is actually a lasting peace.
It is a lasting peace, but not one which is achieved through repression or deterrence or negative matters like that. It's not a negative lasting peace. It's one that has more of a quality to it.
So maybe we can start to articulate what that quality is as we go on. Maybe we should also talk a bit about what the literature had found before that you've actually been contributing to. And there seems to have been like three primary paradigms. I wonder if you could just outline these first around security, economy, institutions.
Yes, there's been a lot of a discussion, for instance, by a researcher named Roland Paris, which did a very important book more than 10 years ago, where he emphasized the role of institutions, and he was more negative, so to say, or felt that it was more important to develop institutions and then after that go to issues of democracy, elections, etc. There is also other researchers that emphasize more the role of the local society, local capacity. And then you have the researchers that emphasize the role of economics in order to prevent the recurrence of war. So what I try to do is to integrate all these ideas as basically hypotheses about what would be a good quality. And then I want to apply that to concrete situations around the world.
So now if we were going to take the, you know, sort of big picture contextual things that you also noted in your book, for example, peace agreements seem to have been on the rise. Is that right?
Yes, they definitely have. And it is a big contrast to the situation during the Cold War, when there was very little of peace agreements, very few, and where the kind of peace we had in those years was a highly negative peace. It was built on deterrence. And then when the Cold War ends, lots of conflicts which don't end automatically. And here you get a lot of negotiations, incredible efforts at mediation, and so you get this rise of peace agreements that have been more than 200 by now since the end of the Cold War. And that's quite unique compared to other historical periods, not the least as many of these are peace agreements on internal conflicts.
There's been a bit of a debate also, it seems, about whether conflict itself is diminishing. When we look at what's in our news, it looks like conflict is getting worse. But there are people such as Steven Pinker, for example, who argue, no, we've got fewer deaths, this sort of a thing, if you look at it from a big picture. What do you say to all this? Who's telling the truth here?
Yeah, both can be right, actually. So what Pinker shows is a long-term trend, which I think is correct, since the end of the Second World War, that the conflicts today are not, let's say, at least not yet as bad as those we saw during the Cold War. If you think about the Korean War, Vietnam War, Afghanistan War, Iran-Iraq War, these were really tremendously destructive conflicts. And many of those that we have seen since the end of the Cold War are problematic, but not necessarily as bad as those. But what the Uppsala Conflict Data Program records is an increase in the last few years. And in 2014, which is the latest they have reported on, it's quite clear a strong increase both in number of people killed and the number of conflicts. So we might right now be at a sort of a transition here where it's very crucial how conflicts are dealt with, whether it will be a rise or whether it will go back to the gradual decline that we saw before.
So if we looked at, say, for example, how peace agreements have been on the rise, if we understand what accounts for that, does it help us to facilitate them in the coming years?
I think so, because the results from the past 25 years show clearly that negotiated endings to wars have a greater chance of providing conditions where there will not be a return to conflict. Victory, which is often what the parties strive for, in fact can result in more recurrence of conflict, and they result in a peace situation that have less of qualities than you would want, so to say. So victories are not necessarily the best solution to a conflict if you think in the long term. The agreements, peace agreements, may many times be the preferable ones.
I want to go back to that in just a bit. One other thing I was wondering is, do you have a sense of why we did have increasing peace agreements? I think your book said something like 178 in the last 20 years versus something like 28 in the previous.
There was more of an agreement among the major powers that we should deal with conflicts in a different way than we have before. During the Cold War, the idea was constantly to exploit conflicts for the particular side's own purposes. One was supporting particular actors and wanted them to win. Whereas after the Cold War, the approach became more one of humanitarian concern. These are bad situations. People are suffering. So let us now, also on the big power level, solve them through negotiations. So there is a connection, so to say, between what happens on the big power level all the way down to the local negotiations. And what has been my and many's worry in the last 2 years is that this tension that we see between Western powers and Russia, in particular on the other side, actually has a negative effect in the way conflicts are dealt with in some crucial parts of the world.
How so?
It means that we are all suffering from the ability or the inability of the leaders of the major powers in the world to cooperate or not. And it is normally good that there is some degree of tension, but when it, because otherwise they become overpowering, so to say. But it has to be possible still to work out constructive arrangements. But what we have seen in the last 2 years has been the conflicts over Georgia, the conflict over Ukraine, and the conflict over Syria, and that has prevented reasonable negotiations and peace agreements in these conflicts.
I think you also note is that there are these different kinds of conflicts, and in fact, what we see today is quite a different kind of war than what we've seen in the past. How would you help us to understand these different kinds of wars and conflicts and the impact that that makes on how to bring peace?
Yes, I think this is an important additional point in this book. That is to separate between conflicts which are civil wars, where the battle is about who shall rule in a particular country. And there is a lot of agreements, peace agreements on this, and many of them fail, but they continue again and again. And then you have those wars where the idea is to separate parts of the country by joining a neighboring country or becoming an independent actor. There are fewer agreements, more difficult to reach, and require more negotiations. But once they have been settled, they are often settled for the long term. So I separate between civil wars and these kind of conflicts, which I call the state formation conflicts. They are about how the state should be like. So if you take examples, you can say Ukraine and Georgia both have very strong elements of this with the state formation. The conflict in Syria, on the other hand, is largely focused on the Assad regime and basically who shall rule in the whole country. And that creates very different dynamics for the settlement of the conflict and how you arrange the situation after the war.
So how would you approach each of these, given what you know about what it takes to make a quality peace?
Yes, I single out three factors which I think are important for quality peace. And one I call the respect for human dignity. The other one I call providing safety and security. And the third one, to provide the predictability that the present conditions are likely to remain. So if I explain that a little more, human dignity matters. It would be to see that if there are ethnic groups, regional concerns, religious concerns involved in the conflict, the solution will have to include something which respects. And in a peace agreement, you can build that in. You can have minority protection, you can make constitutional arrangements, etc. In a victory, it's often one group that rules over the other group, and that, so to say, cements the differences. The second aspect about the security, well, that's more traditional. It has to do with providing for disarmament, demobilization, bringing people from military into civil concerns and so on and so forth. And I think there's a lot of writing on that already. And the third one I think is particularly intriguing to me, and that is if there has been peace for a while, it appears that people are then expecting peace to prevail, and by expecting peace to prevail, it will prevail, so to say. So there is a peace begets peace kind of dynamics. And unfortunately, then the opposite as well. If there has been a lot of conflict in recent history, it is more likely that there will be conflict again. So here we have two very different cycles of expectations, and they have real strong impacts on the way society is functioning.
So that's really about the idea of the self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is, yes. So self-fulfilling and self-destructing in a way as well.
And there are some examples historically that you opened the book with in which there were some pretty bad conflicts, for example, in Europe. But once they came to a quality peace, it's just a new normal that there's peace there. Can you talk about those?
I find that quite interesting. And what I really want with this book is really to point people in the direction we need to look more at this. I'm, for instance, interested in interstate relationships and how do things change between countries that have been at war. You take the prime example in European history, that's Germany and France, where we today expect them to cooperate. And indeed, one of the terrorist groups in Paris wanted to blow up the stadium where there was a friendship soccer game between, or football as we would say, between Germany and France, which is a symbol, so to say, of a peace that has been created between countries that have been at war before. And I'm asking myself, what was central in changing this? That they managed to settle all territorial disputes between themselves. And after that, it was possible to develop the kind of close cooperation that we now see taking place. So I think there is an interesting lesson there for other parts of the world. Do not let territorial disputes linger, but instead try to solve them as quickly as possible.
There's some other things that you talked about in this book, and I just wanted to clarify what exactly you mean. One example was you talked about world order and how much that matters. What do you mean by that?
World order has often been a fairly conservative notion, and it's seen as a degree of sort of stability, a status quo orientation. But I'm arguing that there could be different qualities to it as well. So in one sense, the Cold War was a world order, but it was one building on the principles of rivalry, continuous contestation. Everybody is very concerned about his or her own interest, but not really taking care of what the other one is thinking. So you get this constant rivalry. I call it a particularistic relationship. Whereas with the ending of the Cold War, you get a new kind of relationship, which is more universalistic. It's more, okay, I understand what your concerns are. Let me see if I can meet my concerns, but without necessarily hurting yours or making situation worse for you. And that's a more cooperative attitude. And so that becomes a different world order. It's still big powers, but they relate to each other in a different way. And that is what I mean that the world order can be. It can have a quality other than just being a stability and maintaining big powers rule over others. No, it can have a different quality. And I thought it was interesting to take this concept a world order and give it a little different meaning in this way.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we've been talking about strategies for building lasting quality peace with Peter Wallenstein. There were some other aspects, too, that you talked about. One was strategic peace building. What do you mean by strategic peace building?
This is a concept that has been used very much at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies, where I'm located right now. The idea with this is, again, similar. It is to broaden the perspective here on what peace building is, away a little from the traditional focus just on the absence of war conditions, but try to think of it in a much larger context. My objection is a little that it can become too wide, that it includes too much. It becomes a little too much also of development issues. But if we are talking about peace, we have to bring out factors that really are important exactly for the onset of war or the recurrence of war and the keeping actors in war rather than the entire development problematic. So I wanted to narrow it a little, and that's why I preferred to talk about it as peace building, where you build this quality peace that I outlined.
You also noted that there are sometimes unintentional peacemaking that goes on. Perhaps the best example was what was going on up until the Berlin Wall fell.
Yes, it's interesting to try to understand what happened there and during the Cold War and the way relationships were changed, for example, in Western Europe, compared to how they changed or did not change in Eastern Europe. And it becomes almost a contrast of two victorious powers, but the kind of order, to use that term again, they create on each side becomes very different. And the Western one is a victory, of course, over Germany. But the way Germany is integrated is much more respectful and much more concerned about building democracy, accountability, etc. in Germany and Western Germany in those days. Whereas in the Eastern side, it's much more an exploitative relationship, getting the resources, pushing down the East Germans, making them into loyal allies, but not really developing something that would last beyond the use of power to keep them in place. And you could also see that this is the way the Cold War ends. The Western societies survive and continue. The Eastern ones succumb and, in effect, join the European Union, the sort of former enemy.
If we were going to then stop and take a look at these, really looks like there's no end to the conflict, like what's going on in the Middle East with ISIS and the animosities between, say, Iran and Saudi Arabia. And then there's the animosity between Turkey and its own Kurds and everybody having their own interest in this area. How would you apply your findings about how to create a lasting quality peace in a region like this where you've got so many fragmented interests and so much animosity between groups?
Yes, that's a real challenge and not so easy to respond to. In some way, it confirms some of the results that I present. I mean, when you have conflict and you repeat conflict becomes an expectation of conflicts, and it's like many of the actors in the Middle East are now just expecting conflicts and nothing else. And sure enough, it means they are willing to ally with the enemy, the friends of my enemy's enemies, and so on and so forth. You get the very traditional dynamics here going, which are really hard to break, and that's what I think we can see here. Of course, the way out, I think, for the Syrian question is the central issue, and that is the Assad regime. That's how the whole thing started, and that is the key thing. And if one can find a reasonable way in which Mr. Assad can leave, and you can get a new regime with more legitimacy to a larger group of people in Syria, and that would improve the chances. But of course, we can see Mr. Assad himself have little incentive of leaving, and he, sure enough, tries to make the allies that he can, and we could see him in a picture with the Russian leader, Mr. Putin, not long ago. So he has important backers here, and that is part of the reason why it becomes so stalemated. I've been thinking what one can do, because ISIS appears as an actor and has been able to antagonize almost all the neighbors and many other actors. So in that sense, it becomes maybe a actor that creates cooperation among all the others in order to defeat this particular actor. And that may, in the long run, perhaps help a peaceful approach.
I wonder, too, though, that becomes a victory in your for those people who ally against.
Could very well be.
Would then be counter to other lasting peace agreements.
Yes, and I think the underlying important issue there is that ISIS draws its support from the Sunni population, and that's the majority population in Syria. It's a minority population in Iraq. And so it needs to, in some way, find assurances to the Sunni population that they also have a future. I think that's the real challenge, how to reach to them, because the Assad regime, of course, is based on a minority, not on the Sunnis, and that's part of the rebellion. As you can hear, I don't have this perfect 5-point plan for how to deal with it. It is a real difficult challenge.
I can see how this one would be vexing for all peace scholars combined. What about the case of Israel and Palestine? What would you say in that case?
I've been part of a book project where we tried to think about a two-state solution, but in a different way. It would be a two-state solution, but it would cover the entire territory. So you would be citizens of two different states, but they would all be within the entire Palestinian territory, so to say. Because what has happened in the past few years with the Israeli settlements, the building of the wall, etc., it really makes it more and more difficult to have a viable Palestinian state on the small territories that remain in the West Bank and in the Gaza. So we need to think about something broader and more difficult. So we suggested this idea of two states but one land. And it's a little daring idea, but it is to try to think a little outside the box and try to get a new thinking into also this particular conflict.
Well, that's sort of my last question, I think, would be about the role of the international community, the role of mediators. How important is it to have committed third parties in trying to negotiate a peace agreement?
I think it is very important and often underestimated that you can say that many of the peace agreements that we have seen have actually been mediated through such third parties, and the UN has done it sometimes, but it can be others. It can be the African Union, as we talk about Africa. Clearly, the Pope had a role in getting the relationships reestablished between Cuba and the United States. So there are all kinds of third parties here that can play an important role. I think we need to learn from what has been achieved by such parties before and draw lessons from that. Only recently, in the past 4 or 5 years, has the UN created a special unit for the support of mediation. I think that it is important for countries to put more emphasis on mediation, developing mediation skills, because that is a way in which you can actually get the parties in a conflict to talk to each other, to get new ideas how to move forward and find a way in which they can relax their relationships. They can see new ways out. It strikes me often that when you meet people who are involved in particular vicious conflicts, how their minds is constantly on their side of the conflict and how difficult it is to see the conflict from the other side. And that is exactly what the third party or mediator can do. And it is my firm conclusion from other work that they actually do contribute quite a lot. And interestingly enough, small countries can play a particularly important role because they are not threats to any and they don't have vast international imperial ambitions. And we can also see that small countries do contribute a lot to mediation around the world.
Well, Peter Wallenstein, what a pleasure it has been to host you and to discuss your book, Quality Peace, Peacebuilding Victory and World Order. Thank you so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed our discussion.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.
This interview was recorded on November 22nd, 2015.